Hi everyone, I'm Ilana. We're going to get started, I think. I'm just going to pass around a sign-in sheet, if that's okay. I'd like to know who's here and, you know, if you feel like... Here, Pastor. How are you? Okay. Is this working? Okay. Good afternoon. Today's topic is a difficult and heavy topic, and so this is the equivalent of a trigger alert, okay? Because there are some really difficult things here. Tawdros Greenhouse. He's known to probably most of you who are in the UK. The 50-year-old Haredi, son of a rabbi, Jewish studies teacher, successful businessman, father of 10, who was sexually abusing girls for years. He would lure them into a hotel where he would grope them and kiss them and emotionally manipulate them to get them to do his sexual bidding. He nearly escaped to Israel but was brought back to the UK, where he was sentenced to 13 years in prison. But despite the sentence, the victims, who themselves were Haredi teenage girls at the time and now are adults, they're still traumatized. The judge said the abuse had profound and lasting harm on the victims, who were both undergoing counseling, and that their personal relationships had been severely affected. One of the victims said she was tainted by his touch forever. "I'm constantly afraid," she said at the sentencing. "His position in the community means my entire belief system is lost. He was a respected teacher. His activities were ignored by rabbis. How can I belong to the community," she asked, "when people like that are still in power?" And the judge responded to that and said, "You," to Tawdros, "you have in addition harmed them in their religion. This was a refined degree of cruelty on your part, and you knew what harm you would cause." Even though this case made headlines in the UK, it's really just the tip of the iceberg. Perhaps that's what Chief Rabbi Mervis was referring to recently when he said that we have an epidemic of child sexual abuse in the Jewish community. According to a recent study, sexual abuse of minors is more rampant within the Jewish community than within the Christian community or other religious minorities, such as Muslims and Hindus and Sikhs. The majority of minors are sexually abused by people that they trust or trusted. And over 85% are not reported to the police or to children's rights protection groups. The issue, though, is that a disproportionate number of abusers seem to be rabbis or quasi-rabbis like Greenhouse. He was a Jewish studies teacher, not exactly a rabbi, but in the same category. The Jewish Community Watch Wall of Shame lists over 100 rabbis who have been publicly accused, some tried and sentenced, others still living out and working in rabbinic jobs. And this is only a fraction. These 100 rabbis who are listed, because there's only a 15% report rate, this is a notoriously low number, and it's probably much, much more. So really, what we conclude from this is the really sad and tragic fact that the Jewish community is facing an epidemic of abusive rabbis and quasi-rabbis. And we really need to understand why. We need to understand the dynamic, what's really going on. So there are 4 points that I think are important for us in order to understand this epidemic of abusive rabbis. Number one, Jewish communal hierarchies protect rabbi abusers. Number two, language of community protects rabbi abusers. Number three, Jewish language of modesty and lashon hara protect, they're distorted to protect rabbi abusers. And four, and this is the hardest part, rabbi abusers often receive strong backing from high-profile Jewish leaders. And that's something that we really need to understand. So I want to try to go through each of these 4 issues and just take a quick look, or a deeper look, at how each of these things plays out. Number one, Jewish communal hierarchies protect rabbi abusers. What do I mean by hierarchies? So our community, the Jewish community, is filled with many hierarchies. There's first of all the gender hierarchy, right, where, at least in the Orthodox world, rabbinic groups are all male, which means that not only in the Orthodox community, but in the Jewish community generally, spokespeople, leaders, members of panels, people who have authority and knowledge, are often predominantly male as well. Male rabbis, especially in Orthodoxy, have the final say, have the final decision-making, have the final authority, and it's very hard, especially for female victims, to have any kind of equal playing field. But there are other kinds of hierarchies going on in the Jewish community also. There are hierarchies of authority and hierarchies of knowledge and economic hierarchies and religious hierarchies and hierarchies of charisma. And in all of these, rabbis have an advantage. Rabbis are often on the top while their victims are on the bottom. So what does that mean? If abusers are the one with status and power and victims have no status or power, abusers know how to use that to their advantage. They use it to silence their victims. The emotional abuse, the emotional manipulation, such as in the greenhouse case, the emotional manipulation is a huge part of the dynamic of abuse. We're taught to trust rabbis, to believe in rabbis, and this works to the abuser's advantage. While Greenhouse tried to force his victim into a sex act, he would say to her, "You might as well make yourself useful," which is an emotional put-down, a way to make the victim feel like she needed him, like she was dependent on him. Abusers use their power to lure victims with things like, "You're my favorite, you have sacred time with me, you're special." We saw this earlier this year with the case of Jonathan Rosenblatt, the Riverdale quote-unquote sauna rabbi, who would bring early adolescent boys into the sauna with him and make them get naked. And how did he do it? He said, "This is special time for you. You're special. This is special, just you and the rabbi." And it takes a lot for a kid or someone who's vulnerable in any kind of position to unravel what that hierarchy is and what they're getting themselves into. Abusers prey on that. They prey on their status and they use their status to manipulate. In another one of Avraham Mondrowitz's victims, he described him as a dazzling figure. He said, "He was just the essence of coolness, especially for a little yeshiva kid showing up. He wined and dined me, he took me out to eat, he took me out to an amusement park. He basically showed me a good time and gave me lots of positive attention. I soaked it up. He was grooming me." And then at night, the man, he's now an adult, said Mondrowitz gently persuaded him to sleep in his bed. "He was very smooth and manipulative and really gave me no pause for thinking about what was inappropriate." So you add on to that, after this emotional manipulation and the fact that victims are in a lower place in the hierarchy to begin with, ultimately victims very often are dismissed and not believed. It's much easier to discredit someone who's sort of a nobody in the community than it is to discredit a high-profile, high-status leader who's got, you know, a million Twitter followers, for example. So and one incest survivor named Gnendi Radov, who writes a lot about this, she talks about that feeling of not being believed. She says, "The ongoing denial by the Rabbanim who I approached for help, by my family, was more traumatic and devastating than the sexual abuse. Now I wasn't just abused, I was also being treated like I was crazy, like I was utterly alone." So that's another piece of the dynamic, is because the victim is a lower status in the hierarchy, they're not believed, they're made to feel like they're crazy. We're going to come back to that in a couple of minutes. So what happens is that victims often will have their lives completely ruined as a result of this. The most famous example of this, not the most famous, in my mind it's famous because it really sticks out to me, Moshe Katsav, the former president of Israel, who was convicted and sent to jail for rape, right? For rape not of one woman, of several women. But the first woman to come forward, she was known as Aleph in Israel. They didn't want to show her first name. And in the end, her case didn't even make it into the indictment. So because she wasn't in the indictment, she went on national television in Israel and she told her story in all its graphic detail and a lot of pain. And she talked about how she had to leave Israel. Her whole family's in Israel, but she had to leave because she was turned into this, you know, crazy woman. And she said that she recommended to rape victims not to come forward, She said on national television in this, you know, big televised press conference, she said, all you feminist activists and all you advocates for sexual abuse, you're all going to hate me for saying this. But if something happens to you, don't report it. Don't even bother going that route. It's going to ruin your life. That's what she said, and that's really hard to hear. But it reflects a reality of a lot of victims, and it comes from this, because it comes from if you're abused by someone who's a high-status abuser, a rabbi who's an abuser, he's going to win. In a lot of cases, he's going to win, because the victims have very little power. Power protects abusers. So these hierarchies of power are really important to understand so that we can understand what's really going on when we hear about rabbis who are abused. There are a couple of other aspects of the power hierarchy that I just want to point out also. Number one is charisma, right? People say, oh, this guy is so charismatic. It can't be. Just yesterday in the New York Times, had this big story about Mark Gaffney, who used to be Mordechai Winiers. Mordechai Winiers was known when I was a kid. Okay, he was my sister's counselor in NCSY. They knew then, in the 80s, that he was abusing girls. Everyone knew it. And he's, you know, squirmed his way out of this and out of that. And today he has a whole Wikipedia page that calls him a best-selling author, that gives him all of the status. He's gone from one pulpit to another. And the New York Times writes it's basically a glowing report about how wonderful he is, with a sort of an aside, oh yeah, by the way, he has this troubling past. That's how the headline reads. Yeah, this wonderful guy with a troubling past. The fact that it mentions, you know, his so-called affair with a 14-year-old who says she didn't consent ever and he was 35, he calls it a great love affair. And the New York Times prints this. Yes, he called it a great love affair. And she says, you know, I was 13, 14, it wasn't a great love affair. It wasn't a great love affair, it was abuse. But somehow, even in the New York Times, they can't even get it right. You know, they can't really unpack what we're talking about when we're talking about power and hierarchies in the context of sexual abuse. And part of it has to do with this issue of charisma, because you look at this guy and he can talk and he can emote. And Rabbi Riskin called him brilliant. He said he was one of my most brilliant students. Of course, Rabbi Riskin later revoked his smicha. But okay, at least Rabbi Riskin did the right thing in the end. But you know, that's how a lot of abusers are perceived, as these charismatic figures. But we need to understand that charisma is part of the profile of an abuser. Abusers often have, if you look up on the internet, the 23 signs of an abuser, one of the signs is charisma. The Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde personality, the person who's charismatic in public, but does monstrous things in private. Two other points about the power thing. Power also affords abusers a means to escape. So for example, Rabbi Ezra Scheinberg, a rabbi who earlier this year, a rabbi in Sfat, who was found to have been abusing women for a dozen years, and the rabbis all knew about it. So he, when it was finally came out to the news, he was found in the airport. He was on his way to leave. The police caught him at the last second. Greenhouse also nearly got away fleeing the country. A lot of abusers find refuge in Israel, unfortunately, and we really have to ask why. Why it is that abusers find refuge in Israel, but I'll get to that soon. The other issue is that the power can also be used to manipulate the system, and this has been seen mostly in New York. There were a series of cases where the abusers manipulated witnesses to recant their stories. Baruch Leibowitz, a notorious sexual abuser, was able to use the system to completely terrorize the victim's family. Similarly, Nechemia Weberman, who was eventually sentenced to 103 years in prison for sexually abusing children, the DA in the case described all threats against the victims and people near the victims, and seven people were charged with intimidating witnesses in that case. And the DA said that they were trying to kill the victim's soul. That's how the DA described it. So, you know, power can do a lot of things. In this case, the Nechemia Weberman had something of a happy ending. You know, a sentence of 103 years is rare, but a good ending, quote-unquote. But ultimately, rabbi abusers have access to power that victims usually don't. So that's point number one. Okay. Point number two, language of sacred community. Community, 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 sacred community. protects abusers. Okay, and it's really tricky because we all love community. We all seek out community. Judaism is all about community. Like, that's what we're about. Limud is all about community, right? So, you know, this concept of community can be really alluring and really tricky because it can sometimes be used to protect the abusers. So, for instance, here, you know, in the UK, you all know, I'm sure, about the case of Yehudis whose abuser, Menachem Mendel Levy, was eventually tried. But she has talked a lot and spoken and written a lot about how her family was driven away from the synagogues and kosher shops refused to serve them. Why? Because she was threatening the community. Can I mention you here in this context? Manny Wax is sitting here. He's a tremendous advocate on this topic from Australia. Also has written and spoken a ton about the impact on victims who come forward and what happens when you challenge this community and when you're considered, you know, someone who's going against the community. And Manny's family has paid, and Manny have paid, a very difficult price for coming forward. And I applaud your courage, really applaud your courage. And since you're sitting here, I just want to say that. So language of community is often used to try and silence victims. I mean, in general, we need to understand that the language of community is used to silence critics in Judaism generally. It's not just necessarily about sexual abuse, but when it's done towards victims of sexual abuse, the impact is nothing short of tragic. So it's also interesting, I just want to point out that victims of incest face it doubly, because a victim of incest will not only be accused of bringing up the community or challenging the community or, you know, causing fractures to the community, they'll also be accused of fracturing their families. And, you know, if community is sacred, family is doubly sacred, you know. And so if someone comes out and says, this happened inside my family, they're accused of bringing up the family. How could you do that? Why would you do that? Why would you do this to the family? Look what harm you've done to the family. So this language of community and this language of family is used to silence victims and to protect abusers. And so it's really important to understand also, when we're talking about rabbi abusers, that rabbi abusers who are out there emoting, they're out there, you know, presenting ideas and leading and all of that, that this language of community is a red herring. And we really need to appreciate and understand that. Similarly, point number three, that Jewish values like modesty and lashon hara, gossip, these Jewish concepts, lovely Jewish concepts, maybe, well, lashon hara is an important Jewish concept, not too sure about modesty, but that's a whole different talk. When we talk about modesty and lashon hara, these are also concepts that are used, distorted to help abusers. So for many years, in many settings, rabbis officially ruled that it goes against the Torah to go to outer authorities, the whole idea of mesira, you know, to turn in. You're not allowed to turn in your fellow Jews. But what happens when one of your fellow Jews is committing a terrible crime? So in 2000, in the year 2000, 100 rabbis signed a letter saying that anyone who goes to outside authorities is a traitor. Rabbi Kamenetsky of Aguda in America, for example, ruled that victims must go to a rabbi. This is a psak halacha that he gave, that halachically he said a victim must go to a rabbi before going to any other kind of help, like police or social workers. But what does that do if the victim was hurt by a rabbi? That you have to then go to a rabbi? So this is, it really twists the lives of victims. Many rabbinic organizations in the past told victims to go to the rabbis, and since then some organizations have changed their stance, but Aguda has not. Avi Shafran, for example, who's high up in Aguda, he wrote a column about the evils of victim advocates. Victim advocates, he says, he wrote this, display utter disregard for essential Torah ideals, like the requirement to shun lashon hara, and to show honor for Torah and respect for Torah scholars. I would have added basic fairness to the list, and on and on. So, you know, this language of lashon hara is used to protect rabbis. And often, related to this is the idea that in the hierarchy of Jewish values, a lot of times, publicity often comes before protection from internal abuses. So we can call it, you know, fear of anti-Semitism, like, oh, they all hate us, we can't, or we could talk about airing our dirty laundry, but ultimately we're talking about publicity, it's PR. You know, Jewish leaders don't want to have negative PR, and that's how exposing sexual abuse is perceived. So again, Avraham Mandrowitz, who I mentioned earlier, he pretended to be a therapist, and he used a fake practice to collect, literally used a fake practice as a child psychologist to collect victims. And the Gerer community protected him for years. It was only when there were a couple of non-Jewish victims that suddenly he was reported to the police. But he ended up fleeing to Israel, and he's still protected by the Gerer community. Another case was Stephen Colmer. He was a child molester who actually went to prison at a certain point, and then he moved to Passaic, New Jersey, and there the Jewish community found out that there was a sexual abuser there, and they quietly told their people, stay away from him, beware. But it turns out that even while they were whispering all this, the rabbis had already known 10 years earlier that he was a problem, but they didn't want to do anything about it at the time. They were sort of saying, like, oh, you know, don't make a thing of it, until sort of he landed in their back door, and then what ultimately happened is when they finally made it public, suddenly the rabbi announced, they made it public and they had a public meeting to discuss this, the rabbi of the community of Passaic, New Jersey got up to the meeting and said, he's no longer a problem. What does that mean? Did he go to jail? No. Did he go to the social workers, police? No. He went somewhere, undisclosed. He's no longer the problem of Passaic, New Jersey. He's someone else's problem. You know, this happened in YU also, where, you know, in the 1970s, an abuser was sent to Florida without telling anybody, George Finkelstein. You know, Rabbi Norman Lem, who I have tremendous respect for, he's actually my second cousin, and he's very dear to us. But he admitted that in the 1970s, they had no concept of what to do when they discover an abuser in their midst. So they just quietly sent him to Florida. He's no longer a problem. Like, no, he is a problem. He's just not your problem. He's somebody else's problem. Okay? So this is how the Jewish community often has, you know, the same thing I'm just going to tell you. My college roommate, when I was in Barnard in the late 1980s, she was sexually molested by a Chabad rabbi who she went to for Shabbat. And, you know, he's still out there. He's totally still out there. You know, and she's gone to lots of different people to try to talk to them, and nothing has helped. And because it's a very old story, and it took her a lot of years to come forward, so, you know, that's also part of the problem. It's really difficult for till the victims come forward. But, you know, this rabbi is still totally out there. He's totally famous. He's got a huge following. He's got, like, a million followers on Twitter. Like, I'm not exaggerating. And that's it, because, you know, but Chabad took him out of his post. So Chabad clearly knows that he's an abuser, but nobody can do anything about it now. It's, you know, until other people come forward. So anyway, so that's what goes on in the Jewish community. A lot of it has to do with PR. We'll call it other things. We'll call it Mesira. We'll call it Lashon Hara. At the end of the day, the Jewish community wants to protect itself and wants to protect its image. And this is really difficult, because we have to ask ourselves what this does to the victims. Okay? What this does to the victims when, you know, their story is seen as shaming to the community. Like, oh, victims have to deal with enough shame as it is, and enough guilt, and enough really difficult emotions. But when you add on to all of that the feeling that you're now, you know, an embarrassment to your community, and nobody wants to talk about it, that doubles, that really increases. I don't want to say doubles because that sounds too scientific, but it increases the trauma. And for some victims, they say that trauma of not being believed, just like Gnedi Radov wrote in her blog, that trauma of not being believed is often worse in some ways than the abuse itself, because it keeps it going and it keeps playing with your mind. And because sexual abuse often has that really emotionally manipulative component, so that process of healing has to do with fixing your own mind and learning how not to blame yourself and not to say, oh, yeah, it was my fault. I must have done something to deserve this, which we know is a common process among victims of sexual violence in general. So when you compound that with the idea that, well, the entire community says it's your fault, so maybe it really is your fault, so that makes healing a very difficult and traumatic and painful process. Yeah. Okay. There are lots of examples that I can give for this, but we'll skip this for now. Okay. So just a tiny word, which is that some of this has gotten better this year. In other words, over the past year, we have to say that there is some growing awareness, thanks to advocates like Yehudis and Manny Wax and Jewish Community Watch. There was also a conference this year and last year by Tahel in Jerusalem about sexual abuse in the community. And a lot of rabbis showed up. So, you know, that's sort of a mixed bag. Like, oh, so rabbis show up and so they can say, you see, I'm doing something, even when they might not be doing anything. But nevertheless, the fact that rabbis come, the fact that, you know, lots of people came to this conference in general and it raised awareness and that there's lots of advocacy going on. And I think that the fact that Rabbi Mervis said earlier this year that this is an epidemic, and he said it's a legal, moral, and religious imperative to report abuse. And he said, no one is above the law, and no institution is greater than its members or followers. The impact of bringing sexual predators to light, however embarrassing for our communities, pales into insignificance when the alternative would result in the shame and protecting of criminals, or abandoning victims and risking the safety of so many others. So that's a really strong statement. So we should acknowledge that there has been some improvement. And also what's going on in Australia, Manny Wax can talk about that later, and I highly recommend to everyone to go to his talk, where I'm sure he'll talk about how the Chabad Australia has reacted to him and how things have maybe changed or maybe not changed. And we have victories alongside, two steps forward, a step back, two steps forward, a step back. But still, because within all this, so there is some change and there is awareness, and maybe fewer rabbis are saying you're not allowed to go to the authorities, or fewer rabbis are saying it's Lashon Hara, but there are still some holdouts, you know. So Rabbi Ephraim Padua here in the UK, he was caught on tape telling an alleged victim that it was Masira, that the victim shouldn't report to the non-Jewish authorities. Still, and Agudas Israel is still, in America, is still holdouts. And in Sydney and lots of different places, there's still holdouts. But there's a beginning of a tension between rabbis who are starting to understand that there has to be a different way to talk about this language. I also just want to point out that whistleblowers often have it the worst. There's this guy, Michael Lesher, who wrote a book about this. He writes a lot. He's an attorney who represents a lot of victims, and he gets called a traitor, and he gets death threats. And there was this really awful story about a guy named Rabbi Nachum Rosenberg, a Satmar Hasid in Brooklyn, who was a mikveh attendant. And he walked into the mikveh. He walked into a mikveh and found a man raping a little boy. Like, caught it. And he literally pulled, I'm sorry, I had a trigger warning at the beginning, right? He pulled the boy off the rabbi. And the rabbi yelled at him and said, how could you do that to me, right? And so this guy, Nachum Rosenberg, became a real advocate for victims and has dedicated his life to talking about this and protecting these kids. He said, who they become ghosts. You know, what happens when a kid is, you know, sexually assaulted or raped? He says that their lives are destroyed. So he has dedicated his life to speaking out, and as a result, he is vilified in his community. He's not counted for minyan. He can't walk into shul, and at one point, he was thrown acid when he was walking down the street. You know, things like that. So we need to understand also that the impact is not just on victims, but also on the wider community, and also on the whistleblowers. Okay. Point number four, and this to me is really the most important thing for us to understand, because it's not something that we really talk about much, which is so often we find high-profile abusers who are protected by high-profile leaders. One of the cases this year, the case with Jonathan Rosenblatt, the Sona rabbi, he kept his post. He totally admitted everything that he did, but his board kept him. His board kept him. Also, Mati Elon was convicted. He was convicted in Israel of sexually assaulting boys in his yeshiva. He has never admitted wrongdoing. He has refused to show any remorse whatsoever. And he's invited everywhere to speak. He's still considered a big guy. He's invited by Rabbi Druckerman. He's invited by Rabbi Aviner. They say to him, you don't want to ruin his life. Why ruin his life? Hasn't he suffered enough? Right? So the high-profile supporters, they're supporting the rabbi. They're not supporting the victims. They're identifying with the high-profile abusers. They're not identifying with the victims. Again, and the Mark Gaffney thing, I mean, look at what they did in the New York Times yesterday. It's like, it's unbelievable that a man who has 30 years of a history of sexual assault is still being, you know, described in such, you know, glowing terms. He's so brilliant, he's so eloquent, he's so beloved. All these things, like what? Where are the victims in this story? So we really need to understand, like, why? Why is this happening? Just one more story is in the case of Yonah Weinberg, who was sentenced to 13-month jail term for molesting his bar mitzvah students. So the judge received, judge received 90 letters, all attesting to Weinberg's character and innocence. After he was convicted, okay, so the judge wrote, none of the letters display any concern or any sympathy or even any acknowledgement for these young victims, which frankly I find shameful. And he said there was one letter in particular written by a Mrs. Mandel, who was expressing sadness that Weinberg's love of humankind has turned against him. She said it was the height of chutzpah. Okay? So there are all these people protecting the high-profile abusers. Now, to be fair, it's not just a Jewish problem. Okay, this happens around the world. How many women did it take to complain against Bill Cosby before somebody took notice? Dozens. It took dozens of women coming forward, before anybody paid attention. And then you have other kinds of excuses, like with Dominique Kahn-Strauss, you know, who the accusations against him were dismissed, like, oh, everybody knows, he likes women, he just really likes women. And even in the U.S. Supreme Court, all we have to do is look at the fact that Clarence Thomas is there, despite testimony against him. So it's not really just a Jewish problem that high-profile abusers receive high-profile abuse. Because in some ways, it's much easier to side with a high-profile abuser than with the victims. A lot of it has to do with a certain kind of bystander phenomenon. Judith Herman, one of the trailblazing advocates for victims of sexual abuse, in her book Trauma and Recovery, she says all that abusers need from the world is passivity in order to continue abusing. Intervention, which benefits the victims, is much harder to get than passivity. Okay, so the abuser says, don't intervene, don't do anything, let everything be as it is, and everything will be okay. That benefits the abuser. That's what happened with Jonathan Rosenblatt. They let him, you know, keep his post because he's been the rabbi for 40 years. You don't want to, like, make such a big deal, and you don't want to do anything. Intervening is so messy. It's so messy. Nobody wants to get messy. Okay, so there's that, right? And then there's the issue of identification. You know, Rabbi Druckerman and Rabbi Aviner, who invite Moti Elon all the time, what are they basically saying? They're saying, he's my friend. You know, Moti Elon is my friend. You identify with your friend, he's my peer, he's just like me. They listen to the victims who are traumatized and powerless, and they say, I don't know who that is, I can't trust that person, who are you? You're not a person, you're not like somebody that counts in my life. Their peers, their high-profile peers are people who count. You know, they're important. They have followers, they have ideas, they have, you know, colleagues. So, you know, they're one of me. So that's why high-profile supporters, you know, look at the high-profile abusers as just like me. But of course, you really have, and also part of it is money, right? Shemaria Rosenberg, failed Messiah, writes about this all the time. He thinks that it's all money, and he says because, you know, to remove a high-profile abuser from his post will do damage to the institutions that he's associated with. It could cost institutions millions, and then institutions have to, like, redo their image and redo their branding, and who wants to go through all of that? And it's such a messy, right? Too messy. So Shemaya Rosenberg has all the theories about money, which are probably true. But mostly it's about identification. It's about identifying leaders identifying with the abusers rather than with the victims. And why? Well, sometimes we have to ask ourselves what the supporters, the high-profile supporters of high-profile abusers, what are they hiding? What are they hiding? Rabbi Aviner, you know, who's constantly coming out in defense of Moti Elon, he's been accused of sexual abuse too. He's managed to slither out of it the same way so many others slither out of it. But he's been accused several times and nothing has ever come of it. And I want to read you one more really important story. I'm going to read you this blog that this guy wrote, or pieces of it. When the case of Jonathan Rosenblatt came out and, you know, it was discovered that the Riverdale Jewish Center was still keeping him on, lots of people were like, whoa, that's really... I mean, at the very least, he should maybe have some kind of demotion or some kind of something. But the board of the Riverdale Jewish Center just decided to keep him on. And apparently at the board meeting, there wasn't quite a vote. And this came out later, that there wasn't really a vote, that the president of the board just sort of said, we're doing this. The president on the board, his name is Dr. Donald Liss, was the one who was basically single-handedly responsible for keeping Rosenblatt in his position. A couple of days later, a guy named Andy Blumenthal, who has nothing to gain and everything to lose from posting this, writes, yes, the chairman of the board who overruled the community and is protecting Rabbi Rosenblatt, I grew up in Riverdale, and we knew him. He said, Donald List, significantly older than myself and my friends growing up, frequently invited us to his house in Riverdale to learn Torah and for Shabbat meals, although the learning frequently turned into talk and banter and wrestling. Dr. Liss, as a doctor of rehabilitative sports medicine, claimed great interest in my physical fitness as a youth and my practice of martial arts. He started to run and work out with me and my best friend, and this at times led to more wrestling matches. Later, Dr. Liss provided me the summer job in his and his brother's practice at Englewood. He was quite well off and took advantage of me that way. My family was less and I needed a job. You see how that hierarchy thing plays in? You know, going to the victim's vulnerability. He was at a different socioeconomic status and he felt like, oh, he's giving me a job. Okay. He provided me the opportunity to work out there in their gym during lunch, and then when I would change in the locker room, he would invariably show up. Other times, he invited me to go on vacation with his family to the Poconos to babysit his kids. I remember one particular time I went running out on the trail there, and he came. When we got back to the house we were staying in, he dropped all his clothes in the kitchen area in front of me and in front of his wife, and just totally nude, started talking to me. Other times, when I would work out in my apartment in Riverdale with weights or stretching, he would just show up, and he would invite us for more wrestling. So as I got older and smarter, I realized Dr. Liss's behavior was not normal. It took him years. It takes victims, child abuse victims, it takes years to understand that this isn't normal. And that language of what's normal sticks in the brain. It sticks in the brain and it plays with your soul. That Dr. Liss would now protect Rabbi Rosenblatt and overrule the wishes of the Riverdale Jewish Center is a chilul Hashem and travesty of justice. And he writes, every word in this blog is true. And I hope it helps the community and the victims get over the tragedy and desecration of God. Understand he has nothing, again, nothing to gain from publishing this. He's a guy in his 40s. But this is what happens with a lot of victims, is that it takes a really long time to process. And ultimately, it really begs the question, what is really happening when high-profile members of the Jewish community are supporting high-profile abusers? It's possible that they have something to hide themselves. And that's something that I really hope that we all keep in mind. When leaders support abusive leaders, we need to be suspect of their motives, all kinds of motives. Okay. Whew. Okay, so what can we do? What can you do? Number one, and I cannot overemphasize it enough, believe the victims. Believe the victims. Believe the victims. Judith Herman says, you know, all abusers ask is that nobody get involved. And the victims are begging for someone to just listen. Just hear me. Validate me. Tell me I'm not crazy. Number two, step out of your own experience. Because a lot of times, you know, and we see this, let's say, with the Gaffney thing that just came out. You know, it's like, oh, well, I didn't see that side of him. All I saw about Gaffney was that he was a great guy. He was so spiritual and, you know, so brilliant. Like, that's all I saw. So a lot of times, you know, when we're listening to descriptions, or like Moti Elon, his supporters were like, no, it can't possibly be true. It can't possibly be true. You know, look, I only see his brilliant side. So we need to step out of our own experiences. And this also is a really important life lesson that goes beyond sexual abuse, but just generally. There's an expression in the Gemara that says, "Eino roeh, eino raya," which means if I haven't seen it, that's no proof. That's a really important concept, because a lot of times, you know, somebody says, well, I never saw that side of him. Like, I can't believe that that's true. So you rely on your own experience and your the way you relate to the world and to other people's testimony in the world is through the lens strictly of what you yourself have seen, right? And we do this all the time. We all do this. And what we need to do, though, when listening to victims, especially victims who are describing experiences with high-profile abusers, is we need to step out of our experiences and say, okay, I haven't seen everything. I don't know everything. Let me hear what this other person has to contribute. And number three is challenge social hierarchies. Challenge social hierarchies. Just because someone has status, just because someone has a reputation, just because someone has written a dozen books or been described in the New York Times as brilliant, it doesn't mean that they're not immune to some terrible things. It doesn't mean that they have a dark side. We all have dark sides, right? There's a song about that. But it doesn't mean that just because someone has a million Twitter followers, that it doesn't mean that they're immune from other things. And we need to challenge the way we build social hierarchies, because a lot of times, especially in this day and age, social hierarchies are built by reputation, image, superficial things. And we need to get past that. And we need to understand that just because someone has money or a fancy suit and a Rolex watch, it doesn't mean that they're better, that they're immune to having other parts of their personality. The last thing I'm going to read to you is from one of Greenhouse's victims. We started talking about Greenhouse, and I'm going to leave you with a letter that one of his victims wrote. She says like this, "I don't want to talk about the molesters. I want to talk about the other people, the people who are not sick, who don't have twisted desires, and who have self-control and self-respect. I'm referring to Rabbanim, teachers, lay leaders, from GPs and therapists. The behavior of some of these people is what pushed me to the edge of my sanity and to the edge of my faith. I was lied to, lied about, ignored, pacified, and profoundly betrayed, not by sick, indecent men, but by people who thought they were doing the right thing. I know that many of these Rabbanim do not set out to be cruel. Their actions are not malicious. Well, okay. However, even if they didn't mean to, they caused me horrific pain and suffering. That suffering is on a level with the suffering caused by the abuse itself. Suffering coming from not being believed by the community is equal to the abuse itself. And responsibility needs to be accepted for that pain. She says, the first time I was assaulted, it was in the situation of Yichud. I can count at least five frum adults who knew that this man was being miyachad with me. But they kept quiet. They must bear responsibility for their silence, for ignoring the breach in halacha. I am suffering so much." She says, "I'm suffering so much. If you look the other way then, don't look away now. If in the past you were involved in keeping abuse quiet or abuse happened on your watch, hold up your hands to it. It would help me and other victims if you could reach out and apologize and acknowledge what happened. Please take steps to become educated in safeguarding issues. If you are someone who has responsibility for children or vulnerable adults, provide pastoral care or health care. Please take my message on board. If you don't, if you can't, perhaps you need to rethink your position. Our community must stop being a safe place for predators. If you look away, that invites the offender to strike again. All that is necessary for the triumph of evil is that good men and women do nothing." That's it. Thank you so much. Okay, questions? Questions? We've got about 20 minutes, I think, for questions. Yes? Yeah.
You were billed to say, why is the explosion happening now? Is it just happening now that people are being found out, or has it been going on for scores of years, but it wasn't actually revealed?
Right. So that's really, Sharifi, the question. The question was whether or not there's the explosion is now, or just people are knowing about it now. And that's really the $64,000 question. It's really hard to know. Like, it's hard to know if people are just getting more comfortable talking about it, or whether there's more going on now. It's hard to know. I can't really answer that. Yeah, in the back.
Referring to that, in Israel recently, there were two cases of members of a member of a Knesset and a minister who were accused publicly through the internet. So the power of the internet has really been very, very significant in terms of bringing about those pressures on those people. Yes. The member of Knesset didn't even accuse anybody. He just used words. Mm-hmm. The minister did, and it caused both of them to resign before it even was brought to court. So there is a good chance that internet is doing its job.
Okay, so the point here that internet is really important is absolutely 100% true, because the internet gives people a way to get validated for their experience, to find other people who had similar experiences and who are able to say, you're not alone. You're not alone, and that's exactly the healing that Greenhouse's victim was talking about, that healing that comes from being believed and being heard. So you're talking about Yinon Magel, the Knesset member who had to resign because it was discovered that he was hitting on women all the time, really women who worked for him, really uncomfortably. It's interesting that you say that he didn't even touch them, right? That he didn't even actually do anything. I'm giving a talk here at Limud in 2 days that's called Non-Contact Sexual Abuse, which is precisely about that issue, about what happens when sexual abuse is not about touching, where there's no touching involved, where it's just voyeurism or commentary. And so we shouldn't necessarily dismiss that as like, oh, nothing happened, because things happen that way too. But I just want to add one more comment about the power of the internet, which is that also in Israel, in 2012, a case came out against Emmanuel Rosen, who was a 30-year veteran of television. And how did that happen? Is that a group of women? There was a Facebook group for women journalists, and one woman journalist writes the group. She says, "I can't keep this in anymore. I've got to tell you this story about Emmanuel Rosen and what he did to me." And she wrote her story, and one after another, all these women wrote in group, "Me too, me too, me too, me too." There were about a dozen women who came forward. They all told very similar stories about how he sexually abused them. And the original woman who wrote in that Facebook group then wrote a column in Haaretz. And the column in Haaretz said, it's time to come out of the closet. And that's why she came out and she told the whole story, and that led to Emmanuel Rosen being caught. Now, even more is what happened after that column that said, it's time to come out of the closet. There was a newly formed Facebook group called Ani feministi datia v'gam li'en chush humor, which means I'm a religious feminist and I don't have a sense of humor. And that came out because a few months earlier, Yair Lapid, who had just become a Knesset member, had said, oh, feminists have no sense of humor. So this group, the Facebook group, formed and said, we're feminists, we have no sense of humor. And then a religious group came and said, we're religious feminists and we also don't have a sense of humor. So now this religious feminist group was sort of like finding its own identity, and whoosh, the story about Emmanuel Rosen came out. And one woman, you know, uploaded the column that said, it's time to come out of the closet about sexual abuse. And she told the story, and she told this horrific story, a religious woman married to a Chabadnik who was raped by him, and she describes being raped by her Chabad husband. Okay, which was something that, who would even talk about it? I mean, even today, when you say raped by your husband, some people are like, well, you can't be raped by your husband, that doesn't exist. You know, if you're married, then there's no such thing as saying no. So she started to open up this very difficult discussion, and that steamrolled. So this group, it's called the Fadlachushi group, this group of religious feminists that now has 8,000 members, they spent about 6 months in this group, one woman after another, telling her story about sexual abuse in the religious community. Some men came on and told those stories too, stories about abuse in shul, at home, incest, you know, on buses, on hasa'at, on rides. So this power of the internet is not something to be taken lightly. It's really, really powerful. And it comes from this. It comes from letting go, you know, pulling down the screens and pulling down the distance between people and pulling down the isolation. Because so often, you know, victims feel so isolated. They feel like, oh, you know, the whole world is against me and I'm alone and who can I even talk to about this? And suddenly when you realize that there are all of these people who've been through the same thing that you have, and that it's not your fault, there is something so powerfully healing about that that can't be underestimated. Thank you for that, and that also might answer that question. Okay,
Firstly, thank you, because it's really great that you bring this issue to Limud. Clearly, a one-hour talk is thousands of hours of research.
It's not just
so
me, there's a bunch of people talking about this topic.
It's great, we're just beginning on the Sunday. My question is to do with how do we support, I mean, I'm thinking particularly of the Dutty community, the really Dutty community. Yeah. How do we support those who are coming next? In other words, how do we get these issues to the children and the teenagers who have yet to experience this, who do not usually have access to the internet, who can't get that? So what is being done to gain the support of those adults within those Dutty communities, I don't know what to call them, but that broad brush.
Yeah.
How do we get to the ones who care enough to go into the schools? Yeah. How do we get that message in when generally they're not even talking about sex at all, let alone this sort of, how does that happen? How can we help with that?
So you're asking about, first of all, prevention. You're asking about, are there preventive educational programs to help, you know, to help educate young people about what abuse looks like, the difference between healthy sexuality and abuse, and how do you even talk about that difference when we're not even talking about healthy sexuality necessarily, right? So that's really tricky. I would say that there are a whole bunch of organizations now that are working on this right now, you know, such as Jewish Community Watch and Tahel, ones that I've mentioned, and Gedendi Radoff also has an organization, I'm forgetting its name. But a lot of victims advocates now have been putting together organizations, Tzedek, right, in Australia. So the advocates, the victims turned advocates, survivors, right, we don't talk about victims anymore, it's survivors. Survivors turned advocates have started a whole bunch of organizations all around the world just to do that. And I think that we should all be really, really strongly supporting all of them. It's vital. I mean, it's life-saving. Yeah.
Are any of those advocacy organizations working within the Haredi community?
You mentioned
there's actually been some good news in very limited, but maybe some good news.
Yeah.
I think it's more in the modern Orthodox community and the Haredi community. It seems like they are still close to it, and the rabbis are still giving kisei habachah if you go to a rabbi.
Yeah, so that's tricky for sure, because you still have Haredi rabbis who, like I said, are still giving those pesukim. The question was, just to repeat the question, whether or not this is a, you know, the education that's happening is just modern Orthodoxy or whether it's the Haredi community also. And so I think that I can't speak for organizations about where they're working for sure, but you know, maybe Maddie, do you want to answer this question? Yeah.
Absolutely right. There have been a number of organizations that are focusing specifically in the ultra-Orthodox community. Rabbi Yaakov Horowitz, for example, in the U.S., he focuses on the Satmar community. He's had a lot of success. He's just published a book, sold about 30,000 of them, and he's now translating them to Hebrew and to Yiddish. So there's a lot of progress. They are very much behind everyone else. And I think also when we say Haredi, even within the Haredi community, there are different segments. There are some that are just closed and you cannot get in there, like Kiryat Yoel in New York and other places. So we need a generational change. It's not going to happen overnight, but we need a cultural change for it to be more sustainable, and that is, the groundwork is being laid now.
Do you want me to repeat that? Did I repeat that? So just to repeat that, so Manny Wack says that there is some really interesting progress happening in the ultra-Orthodox community. It's a little bit behind, but there's some writing, there's some advocacy, and there's some really interesting things worth watching, even in the Haredi community. Yeah. How much time, how many more questions? We still have time for about 2-3 more questions. Yeah.
Yes, so much of what you say resonates, but I wonder if I can put it in context.
Sure.
Abuse occurs in every community where there are hierarchies, and I'm now distinguishing that from what I might call domestic abuse, where when we're not dealing with the professional people or people who are in a position of dominance other than in the family. If you think of health professionals, educational professionals, legal professionals, wherever there are children and there are adults in positions of control or superiority, there will be abuse. And there is certainly no greater incidence within the Jewish, whether it's the non-Orthodox, the Orthodox or the Haredi community, than in other religious communities. think of the Catholic Church and the cover-up that's taken place over literally generations. The worst abuse in terms of cover-up takes place within the Asian community, where most of the victims don't even have the advantage that they speak the language of the professionals to whom they could go if they wanted to. And when there is talk of honour-based violence, it really means dishonour-based violence. And but that's a subject for another conference, let alone another day. I think it's also important to remember that in the Orthodox community, all the themes you rightly identify are simply typical. There's nothing specific about the Jewish community. The Asian community, as I emphasise, if anything, is worse in terms of the cover-up and the women being unable to seek help from professionals. As for prevention, it is going to be a generational sea change. There is undoubtedly the beginnings of progress. In the Grunhaus case, of course, he was kicked out of Israel. He was convicted, and Chabad Rabbonim gave statements in order to be able to give evidence against him. So he was rejected by a significant sector of the Chabad community. The only way of dealing with it is education, and I'm now dealing with the Orthodox stroke Haredi community. The only way of dealing with it is education, and of trying to get a local Beth Din, let alone leaders of the Haredi communities, and who have, of course, their own Beth Dins, on board. It is beginning to happen. Certainly, the Manchester Beth Din now will not tolerate sexual abuse, and any reference to them immediately, unlike years ago when it was, well, we'll move you to another part of the community, Moishe, and don't do it again, you know, you shouldn't do it. Now the response will be an immediate referral to the police or social services. So there is a progress, but that progress is not taking place within large sections of the Haredi community and will not, especially because, as I think you have identified, they can't even talk about sex, let alone about these issues.
So those are really interesting points about the fact that a lot of things we're talking about are not unique to the Jewish community. I think that's really important to point out, and thank you for that context. We have time for one more.
Can I just respond
to
that? I think very valid points.
Sorry about that.
I just think it's important. I think important points, but I think in terms of, if we're going to comment about the situation in the Jewish community, the sad fact is that there is zero research, practically zero research, so we don't know what the statistics are, and therefore to say that we don't believe that the Jewish community is any better or worse than others, we need to be careful about that. The fact is, in the US, in Australia, and in Israel, 1 in 5 children before the age of 18 experiences some form of sexual abuse. 1 in 5, 20% of the population. We don't know what it is in the Jewish community specifically. You mentioned Rabbi Nochum Rosenberg before, and his colleague, they both said in New York, 50% of Hasidic boys are sexually abused. 50% of boys. Now, that hasn't been academically researched.
Right.
It is based on their experience.
Yeah.
So when we talk about the Jewish community, again, it doesn't mean the secular Jewish community has those rates, but I just think we need to be mindful when we're talking about that.
Yeah, and research. We need more research. Yeah,
left. Yes, what I was going to say was often when the press, the Jewish press as well, reports in these cases, they describe these people as strictly Orthodox, a strictly Orthodox Jew.
Yeah.
And I find that a little bit difficult because, funnily enough, I've just come from a talk 2 doors away about the worst sins you could commit. And I don't quite see how somebody who's abused can be a strictly Orthodox Jew. And I actually wrote to the BBC about it because that's how they described a particular Jewish paedophile. And they said, well, because he keeps all the laws.
Huh.
Well, it sort of gives it an air of almost respectability because he's an Orthodox Jew. It's sort of not so terrible.
So that's such an interesting point. So just to repeat that, you know, that the abusers are even referred to as informed. You know, he's a tzaddik, except for this thing. You know, this little problem, right? So, just out of curiosity, in the list of the worst sins that people commit with sexual abuse on there?
Yes, but it was, Shabbos was a problem.
Shabbos is worse than sexual abuse?
Well, you should have been there.
Okay, sorry. I was just curious. That was really tough. Okay. Anyway, thank you. One last question. Last question.
Last question is an observation, which, given the interest of the room, compared with the latest developments in American philanthropy, which is two doors down and almost completely empty, I would hate this meeting to leave with a sense that, A, it's down to more research, B, it's down to a generational change due to better education, and it's all down to the more religious end of the Jewish spectrum. And I would say, in a room full of potential and actual Jewish leaders, it's absolutely imperative that the secular aspects of Jewish leadership make sure that their governance, their safeguarding protocols, their policies and procedures, their due diligence of candidates, their references, and all the infrastructure of good management and good man management and woman management are imposed immediately. And any organization which doesn't have governance structures and policies and procedures which are at the highest end of good practice in this area, in the secular world and in civic society, shouldn't be funded by people who support them. And if they are supported, the funders should be publicly named. It seems that there are plenty of levers the community can apply without waiting for a generational change.
Support the organizations that are doing the work in the field. That's really what we all need to be doing. We need to support all of these organizations, like Manny's organization and Jewish Community Watch and Genendi Radoff's organization. They should all be supported. We should all give them all of our full support. Thank you so much for today.